firstly, the day in life of Andy Cowan, peak hip hop connection.
Day in life, it is really getting up 6 o'clock-ish in the morning. 6 o'clock-ish in the morning, because it's trying to get some stuff done before the telephone goes, and then before email goes. So these things will be going all day, and then that's a lot of negotiation. It's just in terms of dealing with words, doing some editing while it's quiet. So
doing editing while you're not on the phone. I mean, that's a mad delegation. Delegating time through the whole day and space to be able to put the creative touches to something, but in the meantime, you're trying to negotiate an advertisement deal whilst, you know, like you say, 4 hours ahead, 8 hours back, whoever you're having conversations with on the phone, it might be another part of the world.
Yeah, you are multitasking, and there are times you just say, you know, you turn the answer phone on because you're never going to get anything done. You just have to, you know, hunker down. But, you know.
What does your family say? What did your family say at age peak? Like, what? Hardly anybody saw you.
The Killer Keller podcast. KillerKellerOfficial.com.
Street Culture TV.
Beatbox created.
Killer Keller.
And we're here to talk about world music and street culture.
Killer Keller Podcast.
Does that feel alright?
Yeah, it's alright. That's cool. So, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, Killer Keller Podcast. Welcome back. Not that I'm even considering you've gone anywhere. You need to be here, nowhere else. Central London, as central as you need to be. Big shout out to all the sharers and carers, people that are getting involved and spreading the gospel on street culture and more beyond. And if you want more of that beyond, hit the Kellervision app, free download, iPhone, Android, for all your sport and art, extracurricular, from mini docs, big docs, to the podcast that you love. We're out here, we're in the space. Get yourselves ready for the upcoming HODL Wars. It's time to graph punks up and get up with some NFT gaming. Also, big shout out to Chief Rocker Gear, from streets to stage. Chief Rocker is the streetwear of champions. And my goodness, this space that I am in right now, I was just saying to my guest, he's about 75, I'd argue 80% of the reason why I'm here even doing this, why I'd even got into the creative arts of hip-hop and street culture more. He was a conduit. He was one of the forerunners of documenting hip-hop and black music monthly in a magazine called Hip Hop Connection. Get in! And while we're here, he's got a new book called B-Side that we're going to be checking out. Just been gifted. Can't wait to go through that. The man, the myth. He goes by the name of Andy Cowan. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm very, very good indeed. So nice to see you, Keller.
Good to see you too. Wow. I mean, I was, you know, again, gushing slightly the fact that for years, me and a handful of others out there, majority of my viewers have, you know, installed like huge amounts of volumes of your magazine in their in their shelves over the years. I mean, that must be quite a thought, huh?
It is. I mean, I've been thinking about it a bit recently. One of our writers, Andrew Emery.
Big up Andrew, yes.
Yeah, he's got a book coming out in March called Right Lines, Adventures in Hip-Hop Journalism. And so I sent him my archive of mags, and he's been going through them to kind of put a narrative together for his memoir. And so they kind of came back to me, and it's 200-odd magazines. So, you know.
Wow.
It's a whole thing, so you can't help but sort of, you know, look back and delve in and it's kind of mind-blowing. I think particularly the early ones, you know, pre-internet, pre-everything, when we're doing anything, everything analog, and, you know, by fax and trust a lot of the time, setting up stuff and things happening. And, you know, it's kind of mind-blowing looking back how, you know, how shonky things were set up, but still it kind of worked.
Shonky, okay, yeah, that's an interesting word. Yeah. With a monthly magazine, now I do these 2 times a week.
Yeah.
I always, you know, there's never enough speed in making an album. It's like, you know, you wait 2 years for something to come out.
Of course.
If you're even happy with it. But, you know, with this, it's just like cut, out. There must have been that as well, where you were, you know, these books this more recent one, I mean, that's a life's work in itself. But to break that down into a magazine where it happens every month, I mean, that's labour intensive, particularly for back then, right?
It is. No, it's really labour intensive. So you basically have a lot of people running on the ground for you, so writers, photographers, whatever. So everyone's doing a little bit. You've got to bear in mind that you're working in hip hop time, half the time, which is say 4 hours behind GMT or whatever. Yeah, yeah. So everything happens really late. probably doesn't happen on time or doesn't happen at all. So you have to make these little contingencies always that, you know, you have to anticipate that some stuff will not happen. So you have to have something, you have to have subs ready to come on, if you like. You know, cover stories get pulled at the last moment, albums go back, all these sort of factors. So you're running a B team as well as an A team sometimes when you're doing a magazine, and having a lot of stuff, and you're doing three or four at the same time generally. So you're always planning ahead.
You got me thinking there, because sometimes lastminute.com on podcasts, someone say, no, I don't want it out now. And it'd be like on the 11th hour.
Yeah.
Thank goodness there's a contingency.
Yeah. Yeah.
How often, because that just raises my heart, my pressure's even thinking about it when you describe it, because you've got so many moving parts in the magazine as well. What if you'd like, I don't know, lost the cover, the main cover story or something?
Cover story is always the one. So we had loads of occasions where a cover would get pulled at the last moment, we were reliant some of the time on record labels sending in decent photos and not getting decent photos and getting, you know, just some rubbish that you have to kind of manipulate somehow around, or, you know, we didn't have a budget to pay agencies or anything like that. So it was, you know, you'd have to be a little ingenious to try and work your way around it.
I always thought, you know, Andy Cowan, the editor, you know, he's this mystical dude that just seemed to get shit done. You were just this, you know, when it said editor in the magazine, and it, you know, you were always a constant, but you never, I'd never see you in a club or never see you, you know, hanging out in hip hop circles like that. So you added this kind of air of like, well,
I don't know. I'm sort of ninja like in my anonymity in a way, but there's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, one, I was editor, but also as we get into the 90s, I'm the only person solely working on the magazine, so I'm kind of doing admin, picture filing, everything else as well as the magazine running it. So I'm just done. I'm up at 6 in the morning, finishing at 6 at night, and I you know, if I go to a jam, I'm not working really the next day. So I have to parcel my time out carefully to make it work. And I think the other thing was I didn't want to be too visible on the British scene in itself, in terms of compromising what we were putting into the magazines.
Because you get too close to the flame almost.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's sort of as a contrast to that, someone like Paul H, who was everywhere in the clubs, you know, taking for people's photos all the time. And he would, he would actually get all the moans and groans and complaints. So you get more moans and groans than you do when you do compliments. So Paul would be frontline, kind of on that, and he'd feed back to me. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't think I was consciously being anonymous or anything. It was just the daily grind in a lot of senses.
But you don't want to be swayed, do you? Like, yeah. I feel you on that. If you're too close to the candle, like you're going to be, some things are going to be said, and you've got to be pretty thick-skinned to, you know, accept certain things and carry on. You know, some things might dictate a whole episode of the magazine.
No, exactly. So we were sort of owned by Ministry for a while, but just over a year. So we were in a sort of reachable location, if you like. So we did have a few sort of aggrieved artists sort of turning up at the door at the offices and stuff. And you know, I'm quite diplomatic. It's all right, but you know, but you can see how things could sort of escalate pretty quickly if it wanted to. Because originally the magazine was in the middle of nowhere. It was in a place, Ely, which is kind of 15 minutes outside of Cambridge. But it's a little market town masquerading as a city. So, you know, you'd never find it.
That is so funny.
And it was just weird. You know, it was a weird setup because it was owned by a company called Music Make, and they owned a load of musicians magazines, so guitarist, keyboard,
that's
review,
right,
and all that stuff. There was one, Music Technology, which was the only one sort of almost a sister mag, which was, you know, had people like Tim Goodyear and Simon Trask, who wrote for it originally, who would, you know, do the more technological side of hip hop. But the rest of it, we were kind of a bit out on a limb, so, to say the least.
It's interesting, that whole idea of it, you know, because I get all the time, it's you're ultimately, your contributors are voicing an opinion that isn't always one of your own, but they'll say things, especially the singles and album reviews, but then you get the thankless task of putting out something that gives maximum exposure, but as soon as there's somebody with a bee in their bonnet and you didn't write anything, that's some sort of responsibility right there, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's not particularly nice, but at the same time, you want your writers to have opinions. They want to have contrasting opinions sometimes, so one writer will really like Tupac and another won't. But and actually, that's fun within a magazine, and writers should have different opinions, and readers should gravitate towards different writers. Writers maybe who sort of, you know, sort of have a similar worldview on hip hop to themselves. But yeah, you know, there's arguments and there's beefs, but you just take it. It's part of a job, I guess.
Part of the agreement.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
For sure, as a young Killer Keller, used to send demos to Hip Hop Connection. I'm sure you remember Prime and Keller and things.
I remember Prime and Keller. We actually used to play it a lot. It was fantastic.
Did
so
you?
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. So you know, that's where I first heard of you. Mm. So yeah, and
95 that was.
94? Was it 95? Oh yeah, yeah. It would have been, I know Stephen Worthy was on the magazine, so yeah, 94, 95, definitely, that kind of makes sense. So,
a rudimentary demo tape alongside a friend of mine at the time called Prime, big up Prime, that's, never actually said his name on the podcast, big up. But you literally saw a lot of newcomers. You must have got so many, there's so many examples like myself that, you know, you wanted to maximise the opportunity and communicating with the reporters within the magazine and get demos through. I mean, big up Andrew Emery. He was actually the one that I'd sent it to, and he was just gracious enough to give us like a special feature.
Yeah, no, we were reliant on what came through the door. We got a lot of really terrible demos that you couldn't possibly cover or do anything with. As anyone who's worked in a record label knows, 95% is probably going to be unlistenable. Same with a certain amount of records. But we did try and listen to everything, and if it was something good, try and spotlight it and give it give it something. So was that your first sort of review ever? Anyway,
it was the first review ever. Wow. It was so full on. And then for a magazine to be distributed, nationally. You guys were reaching parts of the country where no other hip-hop may have existed. I know you'd have been aware of that because you're from outside Cambridge and things have... sparsely compared to the cities, of course, but... Then you had the back, the connection section.
Yeah.
Now, this was like a four-wheel drive for anybody that was stuck out in the sticks, right?
Absolutely, but...
Explain a bit about that. What was the core principle of the connections? And
connections was literally just pen pals. It was a way for people who are isolated or maybe not, but just want to meet up with other hip-hoppers, because you were probably, if you're into hip-hop in sort of 88, 89, you're either in a very secret club with a couple of mates, or you're on your own, and so it was just a way of literally using snail mail and exchanging tapes to doing whatever. But it was just a way of bringing people together, very primitive and simple, but it definitely worked. And I know, but I think we had a couple of marriages from connections
really?
at some point along the line. So
I love
we've got
it.
Some photos for it. So yeah, really? Seriously. So
Paul H type shots.
Yeah, yeah. So,
that's incredible. Did you realise how much of a duty you were doing at the time? I mean, I'm really putting it out there. You genuinely, hand on heart, you pretty much created me.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, because I didn't create the magazines, so it was a guy called Chris Hunt who started it. And he started it in response to a telephone line, which is just an opportunity, I think, that one of the guys at Music Maker Publications saw a guy called Mike Marsh, and they had a hip-hop connection line, which was basically, I don't know if you remember, this is going way back, this is showing my age, but in the sort of 70s, there used to be a thing called dial-a-disc.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, so you'd phone up your 2p in a phone box to hear whatever record they selected last week. So hip-hop connection phone line was a sort of step up from that, and as Dave Pierce doing bit of hip-hop news, but it'd just be a recorded, two-minute sort of segment. You're listening to an answerphone, basically, and him saying, Public Enemy are playing here and there, da-da-da-da-da, and it would change every week or so. And that was what the magazine was born from, was that enough people were interested and kept on phoning this phone line. And so Chris Hunt, who started it, was, that was the basis. And then it was two one-off magazines. There's one late 88. Mm-hmm. One early 89, and I don't know what they actually sold, but they sold enough from to launch it as a proper monthly magazine.
Wow. That's incredible. To have a phone line that you could call and get like the lowdown.
I know.
That is like so
good. And it is, you know, you're phoning an answer machine. So, yeah.
Well, you guys did it, man. And it sparked the imagination. It sparked the imagination. The graffiti section in the back, you know, which.
Facebook. Yeah.
So good. Look, if you guys don't know about Hip Hop Connection, then you're somewhere under a rock, particularly if you're British, okay, and you're into the culture. When did it begin? When did it all start for you, Andy? Like, what got you into, you know, editorial? What got you into, you know, writing for columnists and books?
So, I mean, I started when I was at college. I was a goldsmith, started 85, I think. But about 86, 87, I started doing a fanzine, which is called Only a Rumour. And it was mostly a hip hop thing. It was a sort of indie fanzine, and I was doing photography as part of my course. And there's a guy called David Lubitsch who ran Soul Underground, and he took loads of the photos of that. So he was always in the dark room, doing his photos for Soul Underground, which is this great sort of little independent fanzine. And I saw him doing that, and I sort of clicked the sort of light bulb in my head somewhere that, oh right, yeah, I'm doing photography. I should be doing this. So I started going to gigs, doing my own photos and then writing about stuff. And so I did this fanzine. Basically, it's all me. I'm spending, you know, most of my college time strapped to the photocopier, putting this thing together, which, you know, 20 people might buy a copy, whatever. So, you know, but it's, you sell it for 10p at gigs. And then 1987, November, an old school friend of mine, this guy called Stephen Wolstenholme, says, you know, this gig I think you should go to. And it's the Def Jam Invasion thing, Hammersmith Odeon. So it's O.B. Rakim, LL Cool J, Public Enemy. And he says, you know, I think you're going to like this. And he obviously knows me sort of better than I know myself, possibly, because, you know, I sort of go along. I've read a little bit about them maybe in the anime and stuff like that. But my mind is blown at Public Enemy straight away. Mm. So it's just...
That was a notorious gig as well.
It's just a night. Yeah. So, you know... so fortunate to be there. It's just an amazing thing. And really, my whole music, I mean, you know, I'm 20 years old, so you don't normally have a musical revolution. Your tastes are quite entrenched by that age, but it just really happens. I go off on one. So, you know, I'm still buying kind of indie stuff, but I'm suddenly, so, you know, I'm buying Big Daddy Kane and BDP and everything else. And,
floodgates open, hip-hop.
Basically, the floodgates open, and I changed my fanzine. I changed its name to White Lie, and it's kind of half hip-hop, half guitar stuff. And, you know, no one really kind of gets it at the time. I mean, you know, why are you covering this? Why aren't you? Mm-mm. Because everything is so sort of ghettoized, for want of a better word. But that's kind of where my head is at. And basically, when I'm trying to find work after college, I work a rough trade, packing records into boxes, and I have a sleeping bag distributed by then. So there's some great stuff. But basically, I'm sending out my fanzine because I don't know how else to do this. Just so, you know, here's my stuff. Is anyone interested? And I get a job at Music Maker, where Hip Hop Connection is, but not on Hip Hop Connection, on another magazine, a thing called Phase One, which is for musicians. But anyway, I kind of meet up with Chris and sort of we make a connection. He doesn't have any budget to take on another staff member at the time, but in the magazine I'm on folds literally after 3 months, and I think, you know, well, it's me, I'm back out of my arse, whatever. And I talked to Chris, and he somehow sort of says, well, you know, you know your stuff, it'd be great to have you on, and convinces the powers that be to, you know, put me on the smallest salary possible, but I'm on the magazine,
and that's
amazing. So yes, so
we got Chris.
And so the magazine, what, 8 issues old, I guess, at that point. So yeah, so
8 issues.
Yeah.
When you're dealing with teams, it's finding people with the right energy. I know it sounds silly because, you know, you put out a request to find someone, you know, for a job, and you do get applicants, but to find people that really get it, like are really like level-headed, can deliver targets, deadlines, that's so rare, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's really hard. You know, I know, trying to find writers and everything else, and you get a lot of people who start out really well, but they, you know, they fade off or get flunky quite quickly, and you know, I think it took us ages to get the team we really wanted on the magazine, I think until the early noughties even. But you know, everyone was on board for the right reasons, if you like, or, you know, because we had some really good writers to start with, but because we couldn't pay very much, you know, we only had a small budget, they'd get frustrated maybe after a year or you know, have eyes on bigger prizes and go on to you know, sort of rock mags and
whatever. Totally.
So we were, I tend to think of it in football terms, you know, a bit like, you know, Southampton or something, a feeder club, and you know, people play for us a bit, but then they get signed up by, you know, someone a bit glossier.
Yeah, well, they were going to big things, didn't they?
Yeah, so.
Like Mike, Nihal, for instance, Mike Lewis.
Yeah, there's Echo Eschen. Yeah. There's a couple of Q editors.
Dan Ruffstiles as well.
Yeah, Danny Eccleston, Ted Kessler, they both wrote.
Dan Greenpeace as well. I mean,
so, you know.
So many dons. They've all gone on to like bigger heights, record labels.
Yeah, and you know, so, you know, photo wise, we only really had a few phases of photographers, but obviously we started with Normski, which I think I wrote a little bit in his book,
yeah,
but
I think
that was the biggest signing Hip Hop Connection had at the very start of the magazine was having Normski on board doing those visuals, because it really gave it an identity that it wouldn't have had otherwise.
Pioneer, absolute pioneer in the game. Yeah. And like you say, to have someone of that size, that stature, taking the photos in the magazine, that's just a whole... It's a calling card, isn't it?
Yeah. I used to see Normski at gigs when I was first going to hip-hop gigs, and because I don't look like a, you know, typical b-boy or anything, because as I said, I was, you know, 21, I got into hip-hop, and I dressed like, as I was 20, I was already... defined in terms of how I am in so many ways, but then people say, you know, oh, you're at the wrong gig, or, you know, or whatever, and I get all this stuff. I'd seen Normski's stuff, and then I do remember him meeting him at Hip Hop Connection offices in Ely, and him just being this explosion of Normskiness, if you like. I kind of knew, I had an idea of what he was going to be, but he was about that times about 1,000.
Exactly. Hurricane Norm.
Storms in, so yeah.
Wouldn't run it any other way. Yeah. In fact, he was singing your praises very highly. I think it was on his podcast, actually, about the contribution you made to the book and getting the photos and such. You know.
Some of his archive, just a few really early ones, right in the back of my shed, if you like, sort of obscured. But we managed to get them in the books. So it's the main thing.
That's crazy. Yeah. Back of the back of the shed, you see people. You know, how much did Hip Hop Connection immerse your life?
I mean, totally. I mean, we went through a couple of publishing changes, and then sort of when we get into the noughties from 2001 onwards, I buy the magazine off Ministry of Sound, because I took it from one publisher before Future to Ministry to try and give it a sort of better life for virtually no money. I think they bought it for $1,000,
right,
and they sold it back to me a year later for $10,000, which is a very Ministry of Sound move. But and they put out to tender, so they welcomed other bids and whatever, but I decided I knew enough about publishing, which I probably didn't, but I decided I knew enough about publishing to give it a go. And so since 2001, and then those last 10 years of a magazine, it was pretty much all consuming, because I was doing the publishing as well as the editorial, and I thought I might have known enough, but I really didn't.
Really?
So, you know, we were in some sort of terrible debt after the first 6 months on our own, because distributors, everyone else, they pay 3 months later, but you've got to pay for print and everything else pretty much straight away. So you sort of
wow.
So there was all sorts of financial shenanigans, and I was lucky enough to have a house. So I remortgaged, I think, twice to just, you know, but that means you've got pretty much everything on the line. So. And it was on the line, I think, all through the noughties. So I was, I didn't sleep much, because I was crunching numbers quite a lot of the time. So,
Wow. Okay, let's get into this. Because obviously noughties spawned the new era of how people consume music.
Yeah.
How people, you know, discover and want to know more about music. Internet is suddenly... it. Is that the period you're talking about? What made it doubly hard to kind of keep up with, you know, expenses?
It changes. Obviously, everyone is convinced that all record labels are convinced that the internet is where it's at, and they start deferring their advertising budgets away from print.
Mm.
And that's ultimately why the magazine closes in 2009, is that pretty much we rely on a certain amount of advertising money coming in, not even a massive amount, but it just went. Just labels said, no, we're putting it all online. We're not advertising in magazines anymore. Yeah. I think Echo's Blues and Soul went in the same month
did. Yeah,
so
yeah,
so as I recall it,
was that cut off the?
It was just, you know, we were going to lose so much money per issue. We had been, and you know, there was a point where there was just no way we could do it. So you know, and it was with the sort of heaviest of hearts.
But,
Philip, who was the deputy editor, did do a little online version. But again, although record labels said they were putting all their money into online, they didn't put it into that. So you know, it was more a spectral promise, I guess. So,
interesting. So at its peak. Okay, couple of questions here. Right, firstly, the day in life of Andy Cowan, peak hip hop connection.
Day in life, it's really getting up 6 o'clock-ish
six
in the morning.
O'clock.
6 o'clock-ish in the morning, because it's trying to get some stuff done before the telephone goes, and then before email goes. So these things will be going all day, and then that's a lot of negotiations. It's just in terms of dealing with words. Doing some editing while it's quiet. So
So doing editing while you're not on the phone. I mean, it's a mad delegation. Delegating time through the whole day and space to be able to put the creative touches to something. But in the meantime, you're trying to negotiate an advertisement deal whilst, you know, like you say, 4 hours ahead, 8 hours back, whoever you're having conversations with on the phone, it might be another part of the world.
Yeah, you are multitasking, and there are times you just say, you know, you turn the answer phone on because you're never going to get anything done. You just have to, you know, hunker down. But, you know.
What did your family say at its peak? Like hardly anybody saw you.
It's all right. We just, you know, it just becomes part of what you do. So it's just how it happens, and you negotiate around it, and you work around it. But yeah, I mean, you know, there was one thing where I had this one sort of beacon of light, which is December. We do a double issue.
Nice.
And so we do, and twice as many words and photos, say, but then I'd have a few weeks and I could just recharge and just, you know, sort of switch everything off and go offline almost completely and do that. And that was my little, you know, little light in the dark, a little salvation from work. But I don't want to say it's all stressed and it wasn't fun or anything like that, because it was amazing.
You loved
fun.
It.
Yeah, absolutely loved it. And, you know, certain times you're getting such amazing music through the door all the time. I mean, I think, you know, there's a time sort of early 90s, golden age, 93, 94, 95, 96, where every single album coming through is amazing and it's superseding the last one. Yeah. And, you know, and it's just an incredible, you know, an incredible moment, and incredible to be able to talk to artists around that time 100%. And sort of stuff. And it's a bit before things get a bit corporate and, you know, we can build up personal relationships with artists and everything else. We don't rely so much on record labels and intermediaries and PRs. We get, you know, artists will give us decent amount of time and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I remember the first Public Enemy interview, which was a dream just to meet Public Enemy. And this is,
well, it comes back full circle when you're in it.
Yeah, yeah. And so this is Peterborough Leisure Centre, of all places, and they're just gearing up to Fear of a Black Planet. It hasn't come out, so.
Oh my goodness.
Just before that.
Oh.
Interview with Chuck. I mean, we talk until we run out of cassettes, and that's kind of how it goes. And Chuck is so, you know, Chuck loves the magazine anyway, and was always amazingly generous and gracious with his time. And we do that. We run out of tapes, and he says, I want to make a call to Ice Cube, who's just done America's Most Wanted with the Bomb Squad.
So,
So we go back to Chuck's rooms. You know, he shares a room with Terminator X. Mm. At this point, they sort of together. They have a little conversation. No words, because Terminator X speaks with his hands. Yeah. Gets the keys. Go up to his room, and then we're chatting to Ice Cube for 20 minutes, getting the sort of lowdown on America's Most Wanted. And it's just like this ridiculous, heady night of one of the first sort of major interviews you're going to do. And you just times like that don't really roll around.
No.
I don't really roll around now. So,
is that one of your like most hip hop moments ever? That's got to be.
It's
got to
be. So yeah, just fantastic. So yeah.
Can't possibly. I was going to ask you. I mean, what other highlights were there? I mean, that sounds seismic. That's huge. What other ones where you could say to yourself, that's a pinch me moment?
I mean, there's some strange ones. There's sort of walking down Broadway in New York, and I think the rapper called Scaramanga, but just coming down behind me, grabbed me from there, and go, "Fuck you, motherfucker!" And I just interviewed him 13 minutes before in Raw, because it was just a joke.
Damn New York sense of humor in types people's scare you after death.
But that was. I mean, there's so many early interviews and stuff where we had, you know, with sort of De La Soul and people. Even actually later on, if we go into the noughties, we go into 50 Cent, and we're doing the first interview around Get Rich and Die Trying.
Wow.
And I was surprised how accommodating and how brilliant he was. He really knew how to, in an old school sense, if you think of people like Kerris Warren or Chuck Warren, they know what you want in terms of copy. You can see the paragraphs almost writing themselves when you do the interview. And I think 50 Cent was, of modern rappers, he kind of had a sense of what to say and what to do, and would answer anything in a sort of slightly sort of toothsome Greenwich way, but he knew what to do, and it's kind of nice when artists have that sort of awareness of themselves.
Have you checked out his book?
Which one?
The more recent one.
It's really
good. I've been listening to the audiobook version. It's really good. Yeah, I can imagine he's very targeted and
I mean, very, very bright, marketed his brain completely, which obviously we know, but I mean, I think he kind of over-marketed himself, possibly with G-Unit after the first album and stuff, but he was a bit too much in your face all the time, but...
Yeah, he kind of was, wasn't he? But these must be on archive somewhere. I mean, you must have loads of tapes of people's interviews.
Yeah, I've got a ton in the attic somewhere, which I probably should digitize.
You have got yourself a podcast and a half point. That would be incredible.
And I know all the writers do as well, so you know, we've got something, so that could work in an audio sense. I mean, one of the things that's been ticking over my mind the last couple of weeks is just doing a Hip Hop Connection book, because in 2029 or sorry 2028 it'll be 40th anniversary of the Meg, and it's actually working out how to do it, because I could do a book of my memories, but I think it's really one dimensional, one thing. What if I can do a sort of oral history and get everyone who's been involved through all those different eras, including readers, including, you know, sort of artists who used to read the Meg, whatever, and make it a real sort of 360. It could be really, really good.
So, that could be incredible.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? Somehow, what's the name? There's Wicked Rolling Stones movie, Exile on Main Street, I think it's the documentary.
Yeah.
The way they cut and paste and collage.
That does the Scorsese one?
Incredible.
That's
the first thing that came to mind. It's like this kind of hodgepodge of all different eras that are mapped out in a particular way. You could have a book version, you could have a video version. Hip Hop Connection.
I didn't even consider the audio thing, actually, but there's probably quite a lot in that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and this is the thing, content is king. That's what we've been taught for yesteryear. Like, you were kind of ahead of the curve with that. Like, for you to have all of that on archive, that's content to die for.
Yeah, and the other side, I mean, it's the whole magazine archive in itself, which is dormant at the moment, but it doesn't mean it won't be. So,
what's the scariest moment that ever happened? where you're just like, oh my God, just make this stop?
Oh, well, we'd had to stop publication a few times. And
really?
We've literally been down to the bone and beyond the bone on cash and really? just thinking, well, you know, there is no way forward and I'm going to lose everything. I'll lose my house. So it's sort of, we're done. As a couple of those, sort of head in the hands, total despair, sort of, it's over sort of moments. And somehow we brought it back. I mean, I think I knew when we did close that, you know, it really wasn't going to come back. From experience, you just kind of know, you know, there's not going to be some sort of magic wand where there's going to be enough money to do it. But the only way we could have done it was to not pay writers, to not pay photographers.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't like that model. I think you should pay mm-hmm. people for what it is. So I'm kind of old school mm-hmm. in that respect. Even if, you know, you can't pay them as much as you'd like, everyone should get rewarded. Yeah. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What kept you going? Because it's a long time. You guys were doing it for a long, long time. What kept you going?
I think it's just the music. Once you're in it, and once you're writing about it, once things are developing, it's you're always looking for what's coming next, what's coming around the corner. Mm. It's always something good coming, and you don't want to miss out. So. I still write about music now. I still write about hip hop for Mojo and stuff. And if I was sort of denied that oxygen of hearing new sounds and getting things up front, I think my life would feel sort of bereft in lots of ways. So there's always something coming. And I think whatever era of hip hop and hip, you know, it's been, you know, probably for its poppiest era in the last 10 years in some respects, but there's always something else. There's always a different level of stuff going on, which is amazing. So, you know.
New genres, new, yeah.
Yeah, and just artists who pop up. So, I mean, this year I'd kind of miss his early stuff, but I've been into Billy Woods and all of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's, you know, it's real sort of underground rap, but really, really intellectual, some amazing concepts and stuff. And that kind of reminds me of, you know, Razzcaz, early doors and all that sort of stuff. So just fantastic.
I think that's the problem, really, in my mind. And I don't think it's an age thing. I think with the wake of social media being the main driver of young people, artists, people in general, putting music out, it's almost like they go straight from what we would perceive as a demo to public, you know, elation.
You almost release your demos anyway, don't you? Know, so you release everything as one of singles. So so
people are starving for attention away from the socials, but there isn't anything out there really. I mean, okay, there was different blogs, and you know, when Hypebeast was a thing and such.
Yeah,
but it just feels to me like it's so congested out there. I mean, there must be loads of artists that you see and you're just like, man, I wish I could write about them right now. You know, I'm sure you go through that most days.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It's so hard out there for people to narrow their field and get, you know, the interview or article that they want, because there's not enough publications around, is there?
Yeah, no. And I, you know, I mean, it's weird, isn't it, in a way, because British hip hop has become sizable in a way it didn't when there was print media kind of supporting it. It kind of bypassed that, not by design, but it's a way it actually happened. And you know, I think if it was a hip hop connection now as a print magazine, we'd have an absolute field day. In terms of what we could do, what we could write about, how we could cover things.
Bring it back.
If there's someone with money who wants to talk about it, you know, I wouldn't be averse.
Really?
Yeah, seriously. But I haven't got the funds to finance it myself. So
does it come at a cost? I mean, remind me, you know, especially in 2024, like what
magazine? Yeah, they're really, really expensive to produce.
Really,
it's not so much the editorial, not so much the photography, not so much staff, but it's printing costs a fortune. Distribution takes half your money straight away, and you have you basically pulp more magazines than you will ever sell. So most magazines pulp about 50% or over. So you have to print, you know, sort of over double of what you're going to sell. So if you just imagine the cost of that and the paper costs of that and everything else, the financials are tricky. So
Even in now, even in 2024, that's a sizable amount of pulping.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very wasteful way unless you can, you know, find a way of direct sales. But again, you're probably talking something that's not going to work on a national level, really, in terms of subscribers and so on. So
I stay optimistic. And if you're out there and you want to start putting some money into some publications, Andy's your man. Favorite moment in who's your favorite UK hip hop artist that you'd say, yeah, but I always love chatting with him or having him in the magazine, or, you know, always get a good energy from that person, you know, back in the day or now, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few. I think in terms of back in the day, in terms of people who are great to talk to, there's people like MC Duke, who is amazing. Yeah. MC Mello, who could spin concepts that you know for hours in a brilliant way, and an amazing poetic force. I was a big fan of Gunshot as a band, and that sort of that early Britcore thing, which just, even listening to it now, it just really gets you up and going. So much energy. It's absolutely brilliant. I think musically my favourite British artist probably Roots Manoeuvre. Just can't front on the consistency of the brilliant records, the brilliant production, his own on so many of those, and the voice completely. So, I mean, you know, I know he had a bad car accident or something, because it hasn't been a Roots Manoeuvre album for several years. Yeah, I think so. I'd love to hear some new Roots Manoeuvre. That'd be amazing.
Wouldn't that be incredible? Yeah.
And Witness of Fitness, probably the UK hip hop anthem, I guess. So,
yeah. Easy. Yeah, I would say.
Yeah, yeah.
Detwork Southeast.
Black Twang.
Yeah.
Again, fantastic. Yeah.
Oh, man. I mean, I don't know who coined it, but he was like, it was the Illmatic of the UK, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Without question.
Yeah, yeah, totally. So, and we've got to say, I've forgotten Blade, which we have to talk about. I mean, Blade was doing stuff around through New Cross when I was at college. So,
yeah, that's
know,
right.
So,
yeah, so, that's yeah, right. Yeah.
So, you know,
buying records off the street from him, right?
Yeah. Blade, a massive pioneer, and you know, such a driving force, and finding a way of doing it independently, the first real sort of DIY, wasn't he?
Kind of set precedence, didn't it?
Yeah.
The whole...
Doing crowdfunding before it was a concept,
God, that's good. Yeah, really. Was there any... Because, you know, stick with the Illmatic, Detwork Southeast theme, but was there anything that, you know, got lifted from the magazine and made kind of public that you'd tip your hat and say, yeah, we did that. We made that. If it wasn't a quote, it was, you know, the extra value of record sales for a particular person because you did something in the magazine that just made it pop.
Yeah, I can't think of a specific thing, but I just think a lot of times we got to people, we got to artists, we championed things a long, long way before anyone else did. And I think that was more what we did in terms of having our antennas up and trying to find those points of difference in terms of finding the music and finding artists and stuff like that. So that was really...
Discovering new artists.
Yeah, I mean, that was the fun of it for a lot of us. And, you know, trying to write about people first. I know Fat Lace put... Eminem on the cover about a month before us, but in terms of a national magazine, we sort of got there. And we couldn't get any. We had a really strange cover because it was only pics we could find. But and it's before he went blonde. So
really,
So it's Eminem with a sort of mousy crew cut. But
that's so funny.
Yeah.
I mean, there were some wicked covers as well. I mean, so many just spar on the head, like Wu-Tang. Did Norm do the Wu-Tang photos?
So we did this Wu-Tang thing. The first time we did them, it was just record label shots.
Right.
And I think it was just a phone interview.
Yeah.
Whatever. But then we did an interview I think it was 1993, and it was basically we're taking, it was myself, it was Norm, Angus Beatty, journalist, and we were taking Andy Cole, who played for Newcastle United at the time, and Kevin Campbell, his good friend from Arsenal, and we met them and took them. The idea was that Andy Cole's a massive Wu-Tang fan, and we get them to do this meetup backstage at Town and Country Club, as was Kentish Town. And so all is going well. Norm's all set up. I meet up with Angus and Andy and Kevin. And then all hell breaks loose with Wu-Tang and their road manager, whose name I sadly forget, but she's quite this hardened Norwegian road manager. But they have this 2-hour stanging match, saying we're not doing this photo shoot, we're not doing the interview until we get some cash, so some money, so we can go out and get some food, whatever, the oldest old school dispute you'll find between a road manager and a band, except there's quite classic. A few more Wu-Tang than anyone else.
He was just there completely like spinning out.
and so Andy Cole and Kevin Campbell were quite funny, actually. They just sort of sit there and they start doing cash rules, everything around me. They start rapping it on the stairwell outside. that's a funny moment. And then eventually we do get in, and so Norsey's doing the photos and stuff. There's some confusion. For some reason, I'm introduced as Andy Cole to Wu-Tang Clan. Do I look like a footballer? I'm saying, you know, so it's not me. And then we do the photo shoot and stuff. And then it's actually a really, really fantastic gig. There's only ODB missing, I think. So, yeah.
Wow.
So,
well, yeah, but that was the age-old critique of Wu-Tang when they first started out. Is there's so many of them. You know, they could change the format of the show and some people just would never show, right?
Well, you could do 2 gigs in one night, or you can do it in ski masks, whatever, and you know, you can maximise. They quite a few of their early gigs, they had rookies.
Really?
Or, you know, just wider Wu-Tang members filling in. So, yeah, exactly. But,
well, moving swiftly into 2024, this came out 2023, so we have ourselves the latest book, Andy Cowan, B-side, which I'm only guessing it's the history of the B-side of the record singles.
It's called B-side, a flip-sided history of pop, and this was it's written in lockdown.
There you go.
So what it was, I just had a bit of a moment in during lockdown where I was I decided, and it's a crazy, crazy decision, that I was going to catalogue my vinyl. I've got quite a lot. And
How much vinyl is
that? I don't know, because I didn't do it in the end, so I'm not entirely sure. Okay. But I started, and basically what I started doing, I put a few things on a spreadsheet, but I started listening to you know, some of the first records I bought when I was 11 and 12, and this is kind of, you know, sort of post-punk things. And I was listening to them, and I'm thinking, the B-side of this is amazing.
Yeah.
And then, oh, the B-side to this is amazing. And it's just, yeah, it's just, you know, oh, has anyone written a book about B-sides and you know, the power of B-sides? There's so many B-sides that have gone on to change popular music in one form or another. In rock and roll, you could say Rock Around the Clock, the first rock and roll record, was originally a B-side. Yeah. So,
was it originally a B-side?
Yeah, you say in disco, you say I Feel Love. Donna Summer, again, a B-side.
That was a B-side.
Disco, again, yeah, Glory Gaynor, I Will Survive, another B-side. So there's a few. You get to hip-hop. You have Sucker MCs, Run-DMC.
Wow.
You have Six in the Morning by Ice-T. Just this really emblematic song. You have Public Enemy, Rebel Without a Pause, starts life as a B-side only because they want to get it out really quickly, and that's the only way they can. But it's still, it's unbelievably a B-side. So I know a few of these, and I'm looking around, and I think, oh, no one's written a book about it, and I'm, you know, I don't think any more about it, I think, initially. But the idea is just sort of tapping in the back of my head for a couple of months, and it's locked down. There's not much going on. And so I think, well, what's the harm in at least thinking about it? And then I start sort of putting together, not writing a book, but just putting together a bit of structure, working out a way of doing it. And then I have, you know, I have a spreadsheet sort of going, and then suddenly my spreadsheet's filling up with all these B-sides which are influential for one reason or another, and I've got far too many.
So I
sort of do a bit of limiting criteria, so I say, right, one per artist, and we can get somewhere. And then I have basically a structure for a book. So a book is an A to Z of 500 influential B-sides, and then there's some chapters of different types of B-sides, so it bundles another 160 or so in it. So
has anyone ever told you you're an absolute beast when it comes to this sort of, this line of work? It's just incredible. If Hip Hop Connection wasn't enough, and then you've gone into this whole other space of...
And then, so I wrote that, and then I didn't have a publisher, but I just decided, well, it's not a good time to approach people, but even if I find one, I've got to write it anyway, I'll just go ahead and do it. And then and it took me about a year to write it, but in between other stuff. And then, and it happened. So, and I'm really, really pleased with it, really, really proud of it. So,
who did the artwork on the cover?
And Kid Acne, who is an old mucker from Hip Hop Connection, and an amazing, amazing artist, amazing graffiti artist as well.
Great MC, good all-rounder, really.
Kid Acne's got... Got a new album just out, I think, called Ontology Codes, which is
really
excellent, with Spectacular Diagnostics doing the beats. And he's, I wasn't sure my publisher would go for him doing the artwork. And so I did a sort of deliberately quite bad mock cover myself, and then I got
A or B, I got
Edna, sorry, Kid Acne
to
do one, and said, what do you think? And so it's got to be this one. So and he went for it. So no, I was so happy that he did it. So superb. So
I mean, just this looks extremely comprehensive, which is very exciting. The whole idea of focusing, there you go, Gangstar Dwick, you know. That's just one page, just looking at it and thinking, that's crazy.
I think there's 40 or 50 big hip-hop B-sides in there at least. So it's, if you're into music in a wider sense beyond hip-hop, or if you're just into music, or someone it's...
There's the Cure here, there's
all sorts of stuff. So it goes from 1919 to 2019, so it's all over the shop. So
You strike me as someone with vast knowledge of music, outside of hip hop as well. Just looking through there and all the different genres that you're covering, and you have them in your collection. Isn't it strange how your musical taste really? Well, I find it. I've got a wide taste in music, but everything is funneled through to hip hop. In its mental state, like the B-boy in me just can't let...
You absolutely can't. I mean, I've got into so much music via hip-hop. Anyway, just by samples, by some of those early jazz samples, the Gangstar samples.
Yeah.
So many different strands of music I've never have got to if it wasn't for hip-hop. So, it's just exploring those breaks, and it's opened so many different worlds. And... if my friend hadn't taken me to that show back in 87, and if I'd have missed that, or weaseled out of it, or whatever, I dread to think, because that was I didn't even think about it until I was writing the foreword for Andrew's book, and I think, if that hadn't happened, my life really slipped on an axis there and completely changed and changed the fans I was doing, and changed everything completely. So it's weird. It's a real sort of sliding doors kind of moment. So.
Crazy. I think we all go through that. That's all. It takes one thing that triggers.
Yeah. I mean, what was it for you? What was the spark?
It's a combination of things. It was Hip Hop Connection, without question. It was Paris on the front cover.
Sleeping with the Enemy time.
It was that one. Represent magazine as well, which had DITC on the cover. Just NWA tapes being passed around in the classroom like they were some like illegal sweets. It was just a perfect storm.
Yeah.
Of loads of stuff, and that doesn't mean to say I didn't like it. I still am a big metalhead fan. I love rock and I love punk and I love thrash and anything that music with balls. But what hip hop was the news.
Yeah.
Wasn't it? It was the news. Every aspect of it was telling, not just telling the story. But it was the, the extension of the story in the magazine with a deeper meaning of who these people were, but they were telling a story about what they're going through. Just stuff like that.
And it really was what it was. It was a window, certainly for me, when you hear Chuck D talking about stuff, it was a window into a world that we weren't taught about in school and we didn't know. And, you know, so many lives documented brilliantly on record anyway. Yeah. But you know, the stories go deeper still when you meet the artists. And you know, it's just really, really incredible, mind-blowing, and just musically brilliant, obviously, as well, which we can't forget. And I think that early age of sample-based hip-hop kind of can't be beaten.
Won't be beaten. You know. No way. Bomb Squad, like, it's just a whole nother... It's like the hummer of production, like massive tanks coming through.
It really is, and that layering of sound, just amazing. So,
just alarm bells and... Actually, okay, so definitely DJ Muggs.
DJ Muggs, amazing. Yeah. I mean, have you interviewed DJ Muggs?
No, but I know you would have done.
Yeah, well, I interviewed actually fairly recently, and he's the most intense guy I think I've ever interviewed, because he's so right, let's go, he's 100 miles an hour,
really,
and he takes ice baths in the morning and does things to make him feel uncomfortable before he knocks out 20 beats in a day or whatever he does. He's insanely prolific.
God,
and so, you know, if you think I'm intense, he's 4,000 times what I am. So, you know, he's incredible. What a producer. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Off the scale.
What was the, more recently, outside of, you know, his legacy of Cypress Hill, he also did this other project. Do you remember with the girl singer? I forgot the name.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But he's also been doing sort of soundtrack horror stuff and
really?
Also he's got tons going on, basically tons. So yeah.
Okay. RZA, another incredible producer.
Just amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, if RZA could have stuck to his blueprint, the idea that he would produce every Wu-Tang album.
Yeah.
And, you know, we got the first four or five, didn't we? So we got ODB, we got Method Man, we got obviously Wu-Tang and Raekwon, Only Built for Cuban Links.
Incredible album.
And then I guess we get GZA as well, Genius, we get Liquid Swords. And then there's no way that RZA can possibly sustain production on that level with everything else that's going on that he has to do.
But just
within a couple of years, we have the whole sound bed of the Wu-Tang established. Who is who in the Wu-Tang established, if you like, as well. But just all of those records are off the scale. So, you know, and then later Wu-Tang records, some great ones, some Ghostface,
Came Back Around,
and stuff like that. So
but also Gravediggers as well, like
That's 94 or something. Yeah. That's still really early. Yeah. So yeah,
that came out of nowhere in my mind. I thought myself, G Street as well, wasn't it?
It was G Street, yeah. But it did literally come out. No, we didn't know anything about it, and then Gravediggers appear, and Principal, Fruit Quan, whatever it's, brilliant. So
incredible. Then Diamond D, you know, I think the West Coast was being hailed up by Diamond D and Jay Swift. I think he did the Far Side album.
The Bizarre Rides.
That's
an amazing record. That stands up completely.
Yeah.
So and has a sort of West Coast sort of answer to De La Soul, if you like, and the Native Tongues and all that stuff. So, just amazing. I listened to that recently.
It's still
brilliant. So,
It ages good, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I actually like the follow-up Far Side, but it's not, it's a different thing. But
it's a different beast.
Yeah.
There's something about the liveness of the first album, I think. It was just felt like they were all in a room just jamming and getting on. They probably were.
They could be in the school canteen to some extent. Sort of, the good naturedness of the rhymes and everything else. It's just fantastic.
And that is exactly what makes a good editor, writer, is firing context to really create a 360 picture of what, it's like they're in a canteen table just banging and just being super playful.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
analogy's awesome.
Yeah. But love the Far Side.
Love the Far Side.
Just fantastic. So.
Love the Far Side. And if we're talking about that era, because, you know, we're kind of sticking to a certain period of time, you understand. Midnight Marauders, Q-Tip production, and Bob Powell. Is it Bob Powell?
Yeah.
Again.
Well, you're on an unbroken run from A Tribe Called Quest. So you've got I love the first album, People's Instinctive Travels. Mm. You know, the sort of super laid backness, and you've got the sort of the Stoners follow up, if you like, the Low End Theory, which is just a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant record, and then Midnight Marauders, which kind of tops it. You're just going up and up. Brilliant cover concept, yes. Artwork as well,
which is iconic. Just
definitely iconic, often repeated but never bettered. So yeah, yeah. So.
Man, have you ever done radio?
So, no. I've done a couple of things, but just interviews, so yeah. So,
you're killing it on radio. Crazy articulation, great voice for it. Great voice for radio. Definitely do that, Andy.
So, yeah, I'm thinking of doing a B-side podcast thing, actually, so...
That's a great idea. Because
if I can get Chuck D, because Chuck D obviously wrote B-Side Wins Again, was my original title for that book, so... Which I wanted to do, but yes. So if I can get a few people, I might try and do it. So,
a brilliant idea! I'll help you all the way. Whatever you need help for in a podcast, I'm your guy. I'd love to. That'd be incredible. So what's the future? What's the future of 2024?
2024. I've got a couple of book ideas. I mentioned the Hip Hop Connection one. I'm going to put that on ice and let that percolate for a little bit because it's a bit of time. I have an idea for a book. I can't really say too much about it, but it's a very deep dive into one artist, one hip hop artist in particular, a bigger hip hop artist. So you can guess. And a bit like B-Side goes very meta and goes quite deep. This is going to go super meta. So it's going to go really, really in depth into. Into his career, but it's going to go around about it in a very, very different way to anything that's been written so far. So,
I look forward to that. So
I've got it. It's worked out to some extent in my head. It needs to be worked out on paper. Mm-hmm. So yeah. So, but yeah. So that's starting January, I think. So yeah. So
wow. Yeah. No rest for the wicked.
Yeah.
Exciting times, ladies and gentlemen. My hero, Andy Cowan, inside the place. We're on the floor wherever you are in the world. Thank you so much for passing through, Andy.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Absolutely. It's been a joy.
Yeah, so, it's been great. Woo! Happy kid inside me, 11-year-old guy, absolutely crazy. I'm sure it's the same for you lot out there. Thank you very much for joining us. You know it is Killer Keller Podcast. Out like in was out of fashion. Sharing is caring. Tell a friend to tell a friend. Crime don't pay, but neither do they. Don't talk to anyone I won't, people. You stay lucky now. Peace.